the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Coming right up, we'll take a look at California's first of its kind in the country, new use of force law. The law takes policies in a number of police departments like LA and applies it to criminal prosecution of officers' use of force. We'll talk about what new factors are in play, and then we'll also talk with the LAPD Chief Michael Moore on today's Air Talk. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. My thanks to Libby Dankman for sitting in while I was under the weather the last couple of days. Very good to be back with you. Later this hour, we talk with LAPD Chief Michael Moore about the top issues in law enforcement. But we begin also with a law enforcement topic. Yesterday, Governor Newsom signed into law AB 392. It's described as a first of its kind use of force law in the nation. It's a bill that we debated while it was in its formative stages. But now with it going into effect, the question is, what kind of an effect will it have on law enforcement? Will it mean that the tactics employed by officers are stronger as a result of potential prosecution under this new AB 392? Or does it mean that officers might be a bit shyer about pursuing suspects for fear of being criticized for their tactics or being vulnerable to prosecution because of tactics that don't end well? Joining us to talk about the impact of the bill, Peter Biebring, Director of Police Practices at the ACLU of Southern California. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Larry.
So how do you see this playing out? In what way do you think it'll affect on-the-ground policing?
Sure. Well, with this bill, with AB 392, California will go from having one of the laxest laws around police use of force in the country to having one of the strongest. And we think that will fundamentally change policing in many places across California and will ultimately save lives. What the bill does is change the standard for when police can use deadly force, can shoot, from the current vague standard of whenever reasonable to a stricter standard of only when necessary to defend against an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury. Now, that will still allow officers to use deadly force, as I said, when necessary to defend against an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury, but not when there isn't such an imminent threat, when there's a potential threat that might be down the road, or when it's not necessary to defend against that threat. And that should save lives. And importantly, the bill, as you mentioned, set standards for not just prosecution, but also agency policies and for civil liability. So officers that violate that standard could be subject to enforcement through discipline or termination and civil liability as well. So there is a way to hold officers accountable to this mechanism.
Is there general agreement over what imminent means? Let me use the example of where LAPD officers attempting to arrest a man suspected of domestic violence in South LA takes off. They pursue him by car, shoot out as they go. They believe he's dangerous. He's firing at them. And he goes into the Trader Joe's in Silver Lake. Is that a case of imminent threat there, that individual, that they pursue him, or is that not an imminent threat because he isn't necessarily right away posing a threat immediately to those around?
Sure. I mean, so let me answer that question in two ways. I mean, first of all, I think you're right that what an imminent threat is a question, and one of the strong things about the bill is that it has a very very detailed definition of what an imminent threat is, and makes clear that is the present ability, opportunity, and intent to cause death or serious bodily injury, and it has to be immediate and not just at some point in the future. Now, as to this scenario that you talked about, the Trader Joe's example that happened last year, I mean, I think, of course, every case has to be evaluated on the facts of that case. But look, where you have a suspect that is actively firing, I think that is one where it is clear that they do pose an imminent threat. Now, the issue with trade.
But they could have let him go. I mean, for example, after he fired, then, you know, if he drove away, you could argue, well, he's not an imminent threat because the officer, once he's, you know, you've let him go, then he's not an imminent threat anymore. Now, obviously, he's a future threat to other individuals. He's armed and shown he's willing to shoot, but he's not really an imminent threat anymore, is he?
Well, I think, look, one of the things that the bill does is that I think is a good point is that by requiring that police use force only when necessary and when there's an imminent threat, if there is a circumstance where police can use de-escalation tactics to avoid a deadly use of force, that would, in fact, be required, at least implicitly, by the bill. I mean, whether that particular situation is one where de-escalation was reasonable, I'm not sure. And I think, you know, when you have somebody that's firing and running into a firing at officers and running into a crowded store, that's certainly.
Yeah, although that was later. So I'm just curious, you have a chance there. You can let the guy get away and you remove the imminent threat to the officers. But you create a risk to the public that he's going to do what he did and put under risk all the people inside the Trader Joe. So I'm just trying to figure out in the real world how the notion of imminent plays out. Let me also bring into the conversation Robert Harris, director of the L.A. Police Protective League. Robert, thank you for joining us again. We appreciate it. You're also an LAPD officer. How do you see this playing out on the ground?
I think this conversation that's happening right now is an excellent example of the complexities and difficulties of doing police work. We're having this conversation about what imminent means and what should the officers do, and Peter says he's not sure in this Trader Joe's shooting situation, for example. But we're doing this discussion in the safety and comfort of the studio, and our officers are having to make these decisions in fractions of a second when they're fearing for their lives or they're fearing for the lives of the community. And so this is the challenge and this is the difficulty that our officers face. And so we believe as a law enforcement coalition, as we went through this legislative session, it's why we have been really beating the drum of training, specifically high quality training, because all of the skills that officers rely on every day are perishable, which means that they diminish over time if they're not consistently worked at. So classroom training, watching videos, this type of thing, this is not setting our officers up for success or protecting our communities as well as we could if these officers were being trained. So I think this is an excellent way to highlight that.
Well, now LAPD, doesn't it already use the standard that's included in AB 392 for the expectations of officer use of force?
Yes, Assembly Bill 392 in its current form after the amendments raises the standard to what some of our larger agencies within California are already doing. It is what LAPD is already doing. We already teach reverence for life. We already teach de-escalation techniques and tactics. We already require officers to use other alternatives if it's safe to do so, if it's reasonable. So it's just elevating what some of the larger agencies are already doing, which in the beginning of the season, legislative season, which is why we talked about how we've seen a 40% reduction in the number of fatal officer-involved shootings since 2015, and that's because agencies are implementing these stronger policies and trying to pair that with better training.
Well, and so if this is working with LAPD, this more rigorous standard for lethal use of force, what's wrong with making it a consistent statewide standard as this bill does?
The bill isn't perfect in its current form. It's better with the amendments than it originally was, but our collective interests still remain the same, and that's really trying to reduce the number of uses of force, really trying to increase safe outcomes between officers and the community. And what we've said since the beginning is the punitive approach is not the best approach, and we're trying to get the legislators now to understand that a law alone impacts no one. So So just AB 392 in and of itself is not set up, nor was it ever designed to actually reduce the number of uses of force. I know Peter says it can, or it may, or it's supposed to, but it's not. Really, the only thing that has actually been shown to reduce use of force incidents, particularly officer-involved shootings, is strong department policy surrounding it, high training, addressing root causes of crime, specifically violent crimes, and then keeping guns out of the hands of the wrong people. So those are really the four things that will actually impact the reduction of use of force incidents. So the bill alone is not enough. It's why we're still supporting Senate Bill 230. That's why we want to get the resources and funding for our officers to be trained better and have access to higher quality training.
We're talking with Robert Harris, who directs the L.A. Police Protective League, the union representing LAPD officers. Himself's an LAPD officer. ACLU of Southern California Director of Police Practices, Peter Biebring. He's been at the center of legislation as well as advocacy on behalf of those who have been killed in exchanges with law enforcement officers. We're talking about the effect of the recently signed AB 392, which changes the definition of legal use of force by a law enforcement officer. It would potentially make it easier to prosecute law enforcement officers. However, in practice, it's unclear how that's actually going to play out. And Peter, does this also have an effect on civil suits that survivors of those who have been shot by police officers can take in civil suits?
Yes. The standard that the bill sets, that officers can use deadly force only when necessary, can be enforced, as I said, through discipline, through civil suits, and through criminal prosecutions. But I do want to say I agree with Mr. Harris that the goal here is to reduce deadly uses of force. And I absolutely agree that changing policies and training is crucial to that. And to be clear, the bill will result in that. I mean, it doesn't explicitly say that agencies have to change their training, but it changes the standard for statewide use of force. So, of course, agencies have to change their policies and change their training to conform to that standard. And while some agencies in the state do a lot of the things that are in this bill, and there are a couple that do have standards that are close to this. San Francisco Police Department does. LAPD has aspects of its policy that track certain parts of this bill. There are many that don't have these progressive policies, and many that don't have all of them. In fact, LAPD, although it has a good definition of imminent threat, looks at the officer's conduct leading up to the use of force, which is also in the bill. It doesn't have the necessary standard. It still relies on this overall more vague reasonableness standard. So that will change under this bill.
Do you have any concerns, Peter, that officers might be more reluctant to pursue a dangerous suspect for fear that the methods they use are going to put them in professional or even prosecutorial jeopardy?
No, because there are agencies that have adopted standards similar to this, a handful of them. Seattle is one which adopted a very similar standard under a federal consent decree. San Francisco also adopted a similar standard. And in those places, the agencies have seen significant reductions in use of force without reductions, without increases in injuries to officers or increases in crime or any other indication that police are reluctant to do their jobs.
Peter Biebring, ACLU of Southern California. Robert Harris, director of the L.A. Police Protective League. If you have questions for our guests about how Assembly Bill 392, which is now California law, how that is going to apply in law enforcement, in court filings that there might be against officers, how this might play out in civil suits, 866-893-KPECC. A little bit later this hour, we'll be talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore, and we'll be hearing from him what he has to say about the LAPD enforcement of the policy internally that they've been using for some time. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're just wrapping up a conversation about AB 392, signed into law by Governor Newsom, and its effect on use of force. Joining us from the ACLU of Southern California, Director of Police Practices, Peter Biebring, and from the LA Police Protective League, Director Robert Harris, and just sliding into studio, joining us, LAPD Chief Michael Moore, whom we'll talk to shortly. But gentlemen, before I let you go, I just want to give you a final opportunity here. Peter Biebring, ACLU of Southern California, do you think that there, sometime in the foreseeable future, there will likely be criminal prosecutions that specifically relate to this bill?
Well, what I want to say is I certainly hope not. I mean, the idea of the bill is not, to prosecute officers, but to prevent deadly shootings, to change the standards so that police do not use deadly force unless necessary. And our absolute hope and expectation is that officers will conform to that standard, and that will reduce deadly police shootings, police killings in California. Now, of course, the bill does allow prosecutions as well as civil suits and disciplines if officers violate that standard, and we would hope that prosecutors, police chiefs, and civil juries will enforce this standard as the law requires them to do. But as I said, the goal is to save lives.
All right. Peter Biebring, thanks for being with us. Robert Harris, LA Police Protective League. What do you see ultimately as the effect of this bill?
I see the effect of this bill as kind of an unknown. I would agree with Peter in that it by default will require some agencies to change their policy. And this is the point that law enforcement associations have been trying to make. And that is Sacramento can't just pass a bill and then walk away and expect a reduction in the number of uses of force throughout the state. We need them to be collaborative partners. And it's impossible to just pass a law and then expect hundreds of law enforcement agencies to be able to implement the training behind that. And that's why we need them to stay with us as collaborative partners in the passage of Senate Bill 230, so that training component, the funding and the resources for the training is there. So I do share Peter's objective in wanting to see the number of uses of force, officer-involved shootings reduced. I think every officer wants to see that, because officers themselves don't want to have to be unnecessarily injured or put in those positions either. But if they are, we want them to be as well-trained as possible so that they can handle those situations appropriately.
All right, Robert Harris, LA Police Protective League, the union representing LAPD officers. He himself is an LAPD officer. Thank you so much for being with us. Joining us for his regular visit, LAPD Chief Michael Moore, and we're just going to continue the conversation with your perspective and then get into many other issues. So good morning. Thanks
good morning.
For being with
Great
us.
Great to be here.
So your thoughts on this. How is AB 392 going to practically make a difference, if you think it will?
Well, I think it's refining the definition of the circumstances in which an officer is justified in resorting to use of deadly force. And in regards to LAPD policy, we're well positioned. I believe that, in fact, much of what's been modeled with this bill as far as the revisions and this refining process has taken insight and guidance from what this department's embarked on for more than 5 years. And that is to ensure that preservation of life is everyone's guiding principle, and that the tools, the training, the expectations, the accountability of officers when they determine that the circumstances appear that they have to resort to the use of deadly force, that it's necessary to protect themselves or others from imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury, that calculus that the LAPD has embarked on is something that will now spread across the state. I agree with League Director Harris that what's important in this is that training. What the department has seen is we have invested hundreds of thousands of hours of additional training and development so that officers understand that their safety remains paramount, that their ability to defend themselves and others from an imminent risk of threat of death or bodily injury is something that we protect and that we will back them. We have their back. Last year, 12 instances in which officers were fired on by assailants in efforts to kill those officers, and officers having to resort to deadly force is an unfortunate reality. But how do we minimize that? And how do we try to eliminate? And of course, people have asked me, what is my goal? And my goal would be that we'd go through our ability to police this city without having to resort to deadly force. But what's critical now is that the bill has been passed. The governor has signed it. The department is well positioned. I don't see any adjustments in our policies or how we go about our work. We will ensure that an officer's actions are reasonable based on the totality and that it's necessary to defend themselves. That's our current policy. But what's critical is that across the state, more than 300 agencies and thousands of men and women whose policies may not be as well defined as ours and whose training may not have been up to the level that we have done so far, that there's funding and support for them.
I was asking the ACLU's Peter Biebring about, you know, what imminent threat means to the officer or members of the public, because that was unclear to me. I used the example of the tragic Silver Lake Trader Joe's where the manager was shot and killed by an officer's bullet, because in a case like that, you had the suspect open fire on officers as they were attempting to release him on suspicion of a violent crime at a home. And so the suspect fires at officers, they return fire, and then they continue in pursuit. And so my question is, if the officers, you know, once they returned fire, then allowed the suspect to go, let's say, they remove the imminent threat there. They don't know what's going to happen to the public at that point, but maybe they think, well, the gunman isn't going to, you know, has no reason to shoot innocent members of the public. They're trying to stop the cops from arresting him. So is that a case where the imminent threat could be de-escalated? You let the suspect go who's fired on you to avoid potentially having to use lethal force.
Yes, that's part of our training, is that a nature of it being an imminent threat, an immediate, like it's in front of you, it's happening right now. And absent you taking some counteraction, that the person has the ability to take your life, to injure or kill you or others. That immediate nature of that can be a passing moment. And I think the Trader Joe's is an example that imminent threat was officers are being fired upon. Rounds are coming towards them. And there is no greater urgency than right then in which to defend themselves. Now, we haven't and now once that moment passes, we see a situation such as in Dayton, Ohio, where a gunman who then can go into a crowded location, and now the officers choose to surround and contain him. And that was a dilemma those young men and women had at Trader Joe's, was did they go in and continue their pursuit to stop this gunman's actions, who exact violence against those officers as well as a grandmother moments before. And they had to, we charged them with weighing the circumstances.
Yeah. And how do you, I guess my question is, to me, it seems like a real dilemma. I could see
it
where
is.
One officer says, this guy has fired on us. He's an ongoing danger to the public as a result of that. We need to pursue because there's a threat. Other officer says, well, if we back off after defending ourselves, he's just trying to get away. He's not necessarily a generic threat to the public. Well, so who's right?
Well, welcome to the horns of the dilemma. Welcome to being a law enforcement officer, and welcome to the pressures that we put on young men and women and people in this profession to make critical decisions and snap moments of time, and that we pray that they're right. And that's where the importance of character, of selecting people who have good emotional intelligence, who have a good presence of mind, who we can train and provide insight to those dilemmas. So in this instance, for instance, when the gunman ran into Trader Joe's, did the gunman continue to fire? And of course, in this instance, he did. And those rounds were coming out towards the officers. But the officers, however, did they have a target acquisition? Did they know exactly where that gunman was? Did that gunman start exacting violence on the hostages in which he had? And that was a moment-by-moment-by-moment decision that took over the next hour and a half. And I'm proud of the efforts that our SWAT and officers on scene took to de-escalate and do everything possible to avoid having to escalate that to a continuation of the use of deadly force.
And that, to me, is sort of less of a gray area for the reasons that you're outlining. It's sort of at the initial stage. I think both officers, you know, the hypothetical officers, both are defensible perspectives as the incident is first playing out.
And of course, you know that the city and this department and myself are in the midst of a counter voice of that unfortunately the loss of that assistant store manager and her death There are others who feel that our actions were reckless and irresponsible. So there, this is not a universally held position. However, I found and recommended that those rounds be found in policy because I believe that those officers faced an imminent threat. The Board of Police Commissioners adopted that and found that by unanimous. And I stand behind those officers' actions despite the tragic outcome. But let me change gears a little bit on this, that I think where we're going is a healthy conversation about the use of deadly force and the public's trust and ability to believe that officers will resort to that as a last resort. And this refinement of this bill that ultimately came down to conversations and deliberations involving multiple parties from all sides of this issue, I'm satisfied that where it landed is an evolution. And what's critical, though, is that in each of these steps, that just as the director said, state legislators have to stay in this involvement. They can't wipe their hands of this and say, well, we're done. We changed the law. We need training. We need the support of local law enforcement agencies to be able to invest in that training. When officers off the street for an 8 or 10 hour day of training, that's 8 or 10 hours that we're taking out of the public a resource. And I believe that the state has the ability and has shown in the past the willingness that when it places upon us their will, that it support it financially as well.
We're talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore, his regularly scheduled visit with us on Air Talk. If you have questions for him, we're at 866-893-KPCC, or you can post them on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Chief Moore, along with other police chiefs around the U.S., calling on Congress to reinstitute the ban on assault-style rifles that existed under Senate-introduced legislation from California's Dianne Feinstein. Once the bill expired, Congress did not reinstitute. Chief, why do you think that reinstituting the ban would make the country safer?
Well, there's clear evidence that states that have, there's 50 states in the union, and each of them have their own set of gun laws that control things such as the availability or possession of assault weapons. And in the state of California, assault weapons have been banned for years. And when you look at gun laws in the state of California, which are much more conservative, much more restrictive than other parts of the country, we see per capita safer cities and safer lives. The restriction is no panacea. There are a number of complexities to what constitutes gun violence in this country. And yet, at the same time, we know that the ready availability of weapons designed to kill humans and kill humans efficiently and in large numbers in the hands of distraught individuals, disturbed individuals, a free society that whose current state of mental health support and whose discord sometimes promotes individuals, outliers, to ready themselves and to go and commit these heinous acts. In the last 2 weeks, we've seen 27 different instances across the United States of individuals hell-bent on going out and raising a body count that would bring notoriety to them, that they would go out in a flame of glory. The state that we're in today with social media, the state that we're in today with this hysteria that we have people that are drawn to these, to like a moth to a flame, is enabled by a ready source of weapons. In Dayton, Ohio, a state that had banned earlier high-capacity magazines and years ago allowed high-capacity magazines to now become part of what was allowed, that man walked in there with a 100-round magazine. And by the grace of God and the bravery of Dayton, Ohio police officers, his actions were interrupted.
Of course, here in Southern California, we had the San Bernardino tragedy with high capacity and, you know, many rounds of ammunition in a state where there was a ban.
And so. yet we see that those laws enable local law enforcement and state officials to take actions to identify those that have broken the law, who possess those weapons unlawfully, and we arrest and remove them from the street and take actions that I believe makes for a safer society.
We'll continue our conversation with LAPD Chief Michael Moore, our monthly visit on Air Talk. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back after a live update from Julie Slater. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPCC, or you can post a question on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. We're talking about the letter to Congress that Chief Moore and other chiefs of departments across the U.S. signed to Congress asking for it to reinstitute the assault-style rifle ban that was in effect for a number of years, legislation that was authored originally by California's Dianne Feinstein. Once it expired, it has not been reinstituted by Congress. Chief Moore, you're talking about, you know, places where there's more gun control that we see fewer of these kinds of incidents. You know, one of the concerns is that when you're talking about mass shooting events and the fact that you see a number of these assault style rifles used, that, you know, gun rights advocates argue that's just because they're the most popular rifles. So if you ban those, that people that are intent on extracting mass casualties are just going to switch to other kinds of rifles, that that's not going to make a difference, and that you're going to infringe on people who enjoy, you know, sport shooting of the assault-style rifles.
I want to encourage people to think about this like product safety, like we do with traffic safety. The effort here is evolutionary in the sense of taking progressive steps that when we see the use of a product that it has an unintended consequence, that we put in controls and safeguards. You know, you look at automobile safety today versus where it was 30 or 40 years ago. I'm sure there's people out there that have really enjoyed the muscle cars and the Fast and Furious of the 60s. And look at today's cars and feel that they're overly complicated and take away their freedoms. And yet we know that today's traffic safety today is improved because of speed laws, because of safety restraints and engineering and changes and education to the way we conduct traffic laws and the privilege of driving a vehicle. The privilege of owning a weapon, while some would say it's a right, is not without governance. And I think the government has a right and a need to protect all of its citizens from the reckless or dangerous and or sinister acts of a few. So that could mean and does mean at times restrictions to our basic freedoms. But I believe that weapons of mass destruction, which is an assault weapon with a 100-round magazine, that there is no legitimate purpose for that other than the killing of another individual or individuals. And when you see those actually utilized as such, that we need responsible gun reform, which means high-capacity magazines. We're not saying outlaw weapons. We're not saying outlaw firearms, the right to possess them and that should be something that I, as an American and as a law enforcement professional, support. We're asking for progressive and safety-oriented controls and improvements.
What's the maximum size magazine you think should be allowable by law?
Well, I think that legislature that we've sought here, for instance, in the state with a fixed magazine on a long rifle, so that a hunter or someone using a long rifle has a 7, 8, 9 round magazine that requires a fixed reloading of that rather than just a quick disconnect and then loading of additional 9 or in many instances now 15 and 30 round magazines, that's not a hunting weapon. That's a hunting weapon of humans, of people. But it's not a hunting weapon that you're going to use in the hunting of game. It's not a marksmanship weapon that you're going to use at a target range. And if it is, it is one that poses risks that far out exceed any value or pleasure recreational for an individual who wants to light up the hillside and put 100 rounds of tracer ammunition downrange to see what it looks like. Well, that's all fun, but why don't we allow hand grenades and why don't we allow small tanks and other things? And that's because the sense of the community is, well, no, that's too far. What many law enforcement professionals are saying today, and I join with them as part of the Major City Chiefs Association, is Congress, help us protect Americans.
What's interesting is the divide, though, between rural law enforcement and it's like the same thing that we see politically, that there is a divide on gun control, where many of the rural sheriffs hold the opposite view and are, you know, very strong NRA aligned gun rights advocates, and the urban chiefs, who of course have to deal with democratically, you know, elected, democratic controlled city councils, tend to favor stricter gun control.
Well, two aspects of that. One, one, and I grew up in the South during my high school years, and so I enjoyed, at the end of a high school day, we'd go out and hunt in the afternoon or early morning during deer season and so forth. And so I'm very, very aware of the presence of long rifles in pickup cabs and the utility of those as ranchers and so forth, dealing with prey animals that would attack livestock. And I'm fully supportive of that. I don't believe any of the weapons we're talking about are the weapons that ranchers, farmers, or hunters that I've just described are actually using. And yet we see the consequence in urban America when the ready availability of fully automatic weapons or high-capacity magazines and semi-automatic weapons are exacting such high casualty counts and the loss of so much life. And
of course,
now,
fully automatic is outlawed everywhere in the country.
And the ability to circumvent that is as close as your internet a few clicks away. Now, again, I believe that this is a balancing act of enforcement, of enforcing existing laws, of stressing the criticality of investing in those enforcement efforts. I also believe that we've got to rely upon our communities and it really is incumbent upon communities to listen to family members and friends and others that are in their neighborhoods and in their social gatherings that may have become unhinged, that may have become fixated, that may believe that they believe by a set of circumstances can become active. We've seen today, for instance, from plotting to execution, it's a matter of hours and days. Attacks that used to be plotted over weeks and months or years. And so criticality of these red flag laws, state of California has them. We're encouraging members of the public that see and believe that there are people who pose a risk to their safety. When the hair on the back of their neck goes up because of a 16-year-old boy's rants on his obsession or her obsession or 26-year-old or 46 or 96, whatever the age. But the behavior that poses those risks to one's safety because they believe this person may become assaultive and become in attack mode, we want bring law enforcement in that so we can get help and assistance to the individual who's troubled, but also protect the community.
Of course, it may make some of those individuals who are wise to this go under the radar so they don't have their guns seized.
I would say that the level of disconnect that you see with individuals such as this, their reality is so far away from yours or mine that this idea that, well, if you talk about this, they're just going to go underground. Well, if that prevents these attacks by them going underground, that's okay with me until we can get them help and support to where they're not, where they don't believe and somehow there's some rationale in their mind that it's okay to go out and take the life of others for disagreement over some political discord or some other injustice in their view.
DJ in Riverside says, I'm a former airborne ranger in the Army, and I don't think it matters what weapon you have. Any magazine can be modified to any capacity. You need to regulate the magazine. That's DJ in Riverside. Adriana and Marina Del Rey, going back to AB 392, and its definition of imminent threat to a law enforcement officer for lethal use of force, says, would someone who's unarmed ever count as an imminent threat? Well, I can think of one example off the top of my head. Someone's wrestling with someone on the edge of the bridge trying to throw someone off it to their death. I mean, that would be a case where I would think would be justified. There's an imminent threat even though the person's unarmed. But that's just off the top of my head. Or can you think of other examples where that would be the case?
What's critical here is that we look at the facts and circumstances right at hand. And for example, an unarmed individual who attempts to disarm an officer is now struggling over an officer's gun. One would argue that, well, he's armed, and other people, well, no, he's not. He doesn't have a handgun. But that officer is about to lose control of that weapon, and now that weapon is going to become a deadly threat to them. So that officer choosing to advance and use deadly force in defense of his or her own life, others or the critics will say, well, that was an unarmed individual. The officer got too close. He shouldn't have involved himself or she shouldn't have engaged this individual. What was the reason why they were there? And those are all fair questions. And part of our training and part of our guidance and expectation of officers is how do we de-escalate and find ways to resolve disputes and conflicts. And I'm proud of in the city of Los Angeles where more than 1.7 million encounters between law enforcement officers, between LAPD and members of the public, many of them involving
points of conflict that we resolve many of them. Last year, 33 instances in which we had to resort to the use of deadly force. Many of those were in direct response to officers being attacked by armed individuals with firearms and knives and other weapons. And I think that we're getting it right four more times than we get it wrong, but we're in the perfection business. We're in the business of trying to ensure that the trust of the public is built on the fact that they see us exercise restraint in each of our encounters to the greatest extent possible.
Well, and it seems like the bigger issue is the misidentification by the officer. They think the person is armed, and they're actually not. That's more of the problem that you have with a shoot was not necessary.
Two aspects of that is, first of all, we're seeing far too many people, assailants, offenders, who go out and use an airsoft pistol or a replica, and they're using it in a commission of crimes, violent crimes, robberies, and other things. But also at times, in a suicide by cop scenario, they mean for the officer to believe that is a active and real firearm. And the officer mistakenly believes that it is. And we look at that very closely to see, was that mistaken identity reasonable? Secondly is to the use of where the officer believes a person's moved because of a furtive movement. Something's in their pocket. There's a bulge in their pocket, in their waistband. And the actions of the offender, the officer believes that the person is attempting to arm themselves. We look at those very closely, those furtive movement shootings, to see, again, was the officer's actions, their perceptions, reasonable? Or were they? Was it not based on a set of circumstances? And we do in LAPD. I and Chief Beck before me and Chief Bratton before him have found such shootings at times out of policy because we do not believe that the facts and circumstances as described by the officer warranted the use of deadly force.
Well, and that's where body cams can be very helpful. Not necessarily definitive, but can be helpful.
Body cams are I agree. They're very, it's a two-dimensional look. It's like looking through the peephole of a door. You don't get the full perspective of what's on the other side, but it gives you some.
It doesn't necessarily give you the overall context leading up to the incident also. We'll continue our conversation with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. LAPD Chief Michael Moore joining us on Air Talk. We're discussing a wide range of topics in law enforcement, including the LAPD's use of an informant at an anti-Trump protest. Planning ensuing a public report is expected, and there are those critical of the LAPD say that this harms trust in the department. Chief Moore, what can you tell us about the report on the use of that informant?
Well, I'm hopeful that for that independent review by Office of Constitutional Policing and Policy that is looking at the circumstances of everything that led up to a criminal investigation, and then in the course of that criminal investigation, the use of a confidential informant to attend publicly advertised planning meetings for the November 4th action. That the chronology of that, that the examination of our actions in light of intelligence guidelines, which impact a portion of Major Crime Division's activities, the use of an informant in a sensitive location, such a turn of a phrase, more than really a lawful standard, but the use of an informant at a house of worship, that the circumstances of that, who know what, when, and what was the basis of the actions. I hope to have that report in front of the Board of Police Commissioners here shortly, within the coming weeks. I know I had initially promised and hoped to see this turn around more quickly. My apologies for that. I want to make sure that we not just address the circumstances at hand. I think that this is also an opportunity for the organization to look at the use of informants, what our existing guidelines are, and whether or not those guidelines could be codified more additionally that may give the public an assurance that the use of an informant at a house of worship, for instance, that's an area of work that is not haphazard or just done on a whim.
So you think this could have technically been in compliance with department policy because of gray area, but it shouldn't have been done? Is that sort of what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying right now is let me get the entire report out. I believe this is that the public would best view, engage, and judge its trust in us based on the nuances of what's been said. What's been publicly reported, for instance, is that Refuse Fascism across the country, that national organization and or the local chapter has not involved himself in any violence. And I believe that when we bring the full report and we articulate the basis of what information we had from both published accounts, media accounts, and law enforcement sources, that assertion will be challenged by a set of facts and circumstances that a reasonable person will look at and may come to a different conclusion. So I think that this I don't want to hide what I'm saying. I want to assure the public though that I don't want to snap to a decision and make a premature decision when I haven't seen the final report. I will say that this early juncture, the use of this informant by during a criminal investigation was reviewed internally and approved and was known by myself as the chief of operations at the time, by Chief Grimaldo, who was the chief of special operations in which major crimes investigation belonged to, and Chief Beck was fully briefed as well. And so that individual's presence in those public meetings that occurred at planning meetings at a house of worship, not during worship services, but just in a room there, was known internally, and that in consultation with the city attorney, that we reviewed our intelligence guidelines, and we believe that we are in conformance with it. Now, having said that, is there an opportunity here to look at these set of circumstances and then look at what are the rules and guiding processes? And we may have done everything right. In fact, we may have taken added steps that actually aren't required that I'm suggesting may be an opportunity for us to say, well, let's go ahead and further refine that. And one of the comparisons is that the federal government and law enforcement agencies on the federal government, they have internal guidelines that similarly are in this vein. And if there's an absence of those guidelines with us, could we learn from those guidelines that the federal government uses as added safeguards so that the public can have assurances that house of worship, like a newsroom, are places that are going to be afforded added protections?
We only have about a minute left, but I did want to ask you about the recruitment efforts for volunteers to assist law enforcement officers. What sort of duties would the citizens be participating in?
So there are a host of duties from both at the station themselves, where they can work at the front desk. They can work with administrative positions where they call back victims of crimes and take administrative functions off the burden of overtaxed detectives and station personnel. But we also have recently afforded them with specific training that allows them to be the eyes and ears of the organization, where they go out and patrol in little BMW electric vehicles, and they do vacation checks, and they're just seen in neighborhoods, and they may see and observe acts of where they see evidence of graffiti or trash that needs to be removed, and they really help a neighborhood by having another set of eyes and ears that are from that neighborhood help local government secure and provide for the safety of those
communities.
Not
engaging suspects themselves.
Absolutely not. They have no police powers. We do give them radios. We give them training. We give them strong guidelines. And unfortunately, I have to say that everyone's not qualified for this work. We've had a number of people who want to do this, and unfortunately, they just don't meet our needs.
We'll put a link on the page with more information. Chief Moore, thank you. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. A little bit later this hour, we'll talk with Jonathan Rodden. He's at Stanford, professor of political science, and author of the new book, Why Cities Lose: The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. Fascinating look at for how long America has been divided geographically and what it means for specifically the Democratic Party's political representation. Also coming up, we'll take a look at what's going on in the world of recruitment of women into STEM education. There's some legal challenges under Title IX to women-only scholarships, women-only outreach programs, workshops and the like that schools use to try and attract more women to STEM education. There are those who say that runs foul of Title IX and that is essentially gender discriminatory. We'll hear the legal pros and cons on that. But first, we turn our attention to the announcement from the Trump administration this morning. It's moving to end longstanding federal court agreement limiting how long immigrant children can be kept in detention with their family members. As you might recall, kids were being released less than 20 days after being in federal custody so that wouldn't run afoul of what's known as the Flores Agreement. Sometimes that meant that families were separated. The parents were kept in detention. The kids were placed with foster families, or if they had relatives in the U.S., they might go there. This plan would attempt to pull the U.S. out of Flores, have the kids stay with their families for more than 20 days. Molly O'Toole, Los Angeles Times, D.C.-based immigration and security reporter, joins us. Molly, first of all, can the U.S. just pull out of Flores? That's a federal agreement, isn't it?
Well, there's some that's part of what the moves today are very interesting, and there's some debate around that. It is the new regulations, essentially the way the Trump administration did this is by publishing new rules in the Federal Register, and those are going to be formally, officially published on Friday, that says that that ruling has been terminated because they've come up with new regulations that fit the terms of the settlement. And the settlement of itself has sort of some language that is currently at the center of this now that says, you know, essentially, you know, pending new regulations from the government. So that's what the Trump administration is arguing. Of course, you know, we have advocates for migrant children and families, and even the original lawyers who were part of the original Flores case back in the 80s and 90s, who are saying that these new regulations would not meet the terms of the settlement, that this is illegal and sort of a way to just get out of the terms of the settlement. Those lawyers have a week to file against the new regulations to say they don't meet the terms of the settlement. And then, of course, other litigation is expected to try and block the regulations from going into place in 60 days.
Do you have a sense of what sorts of supports are available for kids who are held in federal detention? I mean, they have access to education. Do they have access to all the different things that they need, even if you accept the premise of them being kept in custody more than 3 weeks?
Well, it really runs the gamut. And obviously, over the summer, there was sort of a widening scandal about the conditions that children were being held in. Now, those were typically conditions in temporary detention facilities, but it sort of highlighted broader issues with providing care. At certain points, the government has argued that they don't have to provide education, they don't have to provide recreational opportunities. They even tried to argue that they don't have to provide toothbrushes and opportunities to bathe for migrants that are held in their care. So while the Trump administration said that they, with the new regulations, they're going to be adopting the same standards that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, uses for adults held in detention, which would include, you know, recreation, education, sort of basic health and safety standards, clearly there's been a very mixed record in which the administration has tried to do less and less when it comes to the standards of care that migrants are being held in.
Hmm. Molly, this obviously is going to face legal challenge. You know, given that there is the agreement that stands at this point, is it just going to be up to a court's interpretation of what new government standard means under that agreement?
I mean, I think we've seen this repeatedly with the Trump administration and their broader efforts. I mean, all of this is part of a pattern, a broader effort, an explicit one by the Trump administration to restrict immigration, both legal and illegal, and any benefits or standards of care to which migrants under U.S. law are entitled. And as we've seen with that pattern, all of these steps that are being taken, you know, whether through executive legislative action or federal regulation, new rules such as this one, just the form that this is taking, it's often been left up to the courts to decide. Lawmakers, for example, who really set the foundation for U.S. immigration law decades ago have had virtually no role. It's basically between the Trump administration and the courts.
We're talking with Molly O'Toole, L.A. Times reporter. She's based in Washington. Immigration and Security, the beat that she covers. Molly, what's been the response from Republicans in Congress to this? Obviously, Democrats are going to be strongly opposed and see this as, an executive overreach as well as being cruel to the children. But what's been the response from Republicans?
Well, we've seen the response from conservative groups and also from Republicans in Congress that have come out in support of these new regulations because the argument is that the Flores ruling in 1997, and then there was sort of a narrowed ruling in 2015, which said that migrant children, whether or not they were traveling by themselves or with a family, had to generally be released as soon as possible and within 20 days. They argue that that ruling is a quote-unquote loophole, a legal loophole that has been actually pulling Central American asylum-seeking families to the United States because of an understanding that families with children and children will be released into the United States. That's the argument. So they've come out in support of this, saying that it will act as a deterrent, that it will reduce migration to the southern border. It should be noted that more or less Democratic and Republican administrations since 1994 was the first time there was actually a national border security strategy. Deterrence has been the U.S. primary strategy to try and reduce migration to the southern border. And of course, as we've seen, those numbers have gone up and down. But since 1994, that deterrence has not worked. So it's sort of still to be seen whether terminating the Flores ruling would act as a deterrent in this case also.
Molly O'Toole, thanks so much. Appreciate your talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
LA Times reporter on immigration and security. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. There's good news in education when it comes to STEM fields. There has been a dramatic increase in the number of women who are going into STEM. Some of that certainly can be attributed to recruiting of colleges and universities, programs to try and encourage girls to go into STEM in higher education, even scholarships that have been provided to girls and young women to go into STEM ed. But there are those who say that having specifically gender-targeted approaches like that are discriminatory against male students. And they say that it, in fact, violates Title IX, the gender equity provision in federal law. With us to talk about how this all plays out is Everett Bartlett, president of the Stop Abusive and Violent Environments Title IX Equity Project. They filed administrative complaints against the Civil Rights Office with the Department of Education. Mr. Bartlett, thank you for being with us. Why do you think that these STEM, as well as other areas of recruitment for women, run afoul of Title IX?
Yeah, well, great question, and it's a fair question. So let's take a step backwards. We've found over the past 40 years, there's really been a remarkable transformation in higher education. In 1981, the number of male and female students enrolled in college was equal. But since 1981, that percentage of male students has steadily fallen and is now only 40%. So our Title IX Equity Project looked at the sex-specific scholarships at the largest universities all around the country, and we found a shocking disparity. In every state that we looked at, the number of female-specific scholarships, and they're not just STEM, there are many other issues and fields they cover, but these female-specific scholarships vastly outnumber the scholarships for male students. Sadly, California was among the worst of the states that we reviewed, if we look at the largest California colleges, and I can give you the names if you want, they offer a total of 4 scholarship programs for men compared to 117 scholarships only for female students. That's almost a 30-fold disparity. So when male students, male enrollments are plummeting, a 30-fold disparity that favors females doesn't quite make sense.
In the case of STEM specifically, though, we've got science, technology, engineering, math, where women have historically been severely underrepresented. Now, we're starting to see shifts in that, given fields of science where we're seeing many more women come into that. So you could argue that these programs would at least been part of that success. Why would it be wrong to continue these specifically for STEM when you are trying to address what's a historic underrepresentation in the field?
Well, so first of all, there is no female underrepresentation in the STEM fields, at least according to the Council of Graduate Schools. This is their graduate school enrollment in 2017. They report it's 51% female, 49% male. Now, if you start, drilling down and looking at specific areas like engineering or like mathematics, yes, you do see underrepresentation of females. But if we're going to be fair about this, why are we not also talking about the historic underrepresentation of males in areas like public administration, education, nursing, psychology? The list goes on and on and on. And the male underrepresentation in those fields is actually greater than the female underrepresentation in, say, mathematics and computer sciences.
Everett Bartlett, thank you for being with us. I appreciate you laying out the position of your organization called the Save Title IX Equity Project. He's president of the group, which filed administrative complaints with the U.S. Department of Education Office of Civil Rights. My question for you as an AirTalk listener is, do you think that it is fair for schools to offer special programs, scholarship, what are female student-centric or prospective students, female-centric ways of trying to get girls and young women into STEM? Does it make sense that they do this sort of a recruitment effort or in targeting one specific gender? Is that discriminatory? Does it run afoul of Title IX? And, those are sort of two separate questions. The one is it ethically right to do it? Secondly, is it legal to do it under the Title IX federal regulations? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Maybe you're someone who's benefited from what is a woman-centric scholarship or outreach or specialized program, or maybe you felt excluded. You're a man going into STEM and you felt that there's been a reverse discrimination. 866-893-KPECC. We'll continue our conversation with University of Laverne law professor Diane Klein. We'll also talk with a professor at the Western New England University School of Law, Erin Bouzouvis. We'll hear what she has to say about this as well and where the legalities of Title IX come down on this. We'll continue in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Very good to have you with us as we talk about challenges to colleges and universities offering women-centric scholarship and programs to increase representation in STEM fields of education. Like to hear your thoughts about that at 866-893-KPCC. With us from the University of Laverne, where she's professor of law and specializes in civil rights, education law, and anti-discrimination law, Diane Klein. Professor, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Larry.
So, setting aside sort of whether this is a good thing or not generally, to try and recruit more women into STEM education, what do you think Title IX says about this? Is it potentially discriminatory to do this?
Well, the goal of Title IX when it was first enacted was to eliminate discrimination on the basis of sex in the educational setting, from the primary setting on up through the university, and specifically the kind of discrimination that it had in mind was discrimination against women, not just discrimination on the basis of sex more generally, but ways in which women had been systematically excluded from equal educational opportunities in the United States. And in addition to Title IX itself, there are federal regulations that implement laws of this type. And in the Code of Federal Regulations used to implement Title IX is a specific permission for the use of affirmative action to achieve this goal. So it is not simply that Title IX requires the removal of barriers, right? For example, if a program did not admit women, did not consider applications from women, they would not be allowed to do that. The Code of Federal Regulations in this area specifically permits institutions to use affirmative action to take appropriate remedial steps to eliminate the effects of any discrimination which resulted or may have resulted from adherence to their prior policies and practices, even if they have not been found to be in violation by the Department of Education, Department of Justice, Office of Civil Rights, or any other body. Institutions are allowed to do this affirmatively and at their own initiative. And what I find from opponents of affirmative action in this area, as in many areas, is a failure to understand what seems to some of us like pretty basic principles of cause and effect. To say that we don't need affirmative action here because statistics about women's participation in some of these fields have markedly improved in recent decades, which is certainly true, although it's a partial picture, is like saying that because seatbelts have so reduced highway fatalities, we don't need to use seatbelts anymore.
So you're saying the reason that there are many more women working in STEM is because of programs like what these universities are doing?
Yes, a variety of innovative programs intended to not merely reduce barriers, but what programs found was just because they would admit women didn't mean that women showed up in the kinds of numbers that would suggest that real substantive equality of opportunity existed in those fields. That's what these scholarships, special programs, and so on are all designed to accomplish in a highly targeted and institution-specific way.
We're talking with University of Laverne law professor Diane Klein, also with us from Western New England University, where she's professor of law, Erin Bezuvis. Professor, thank you so much for joining us, given Title IX is one of your specialties. Be interested to hear your thoughts on this. Do you think it's clear how Title IX would apply here?
Well, it's my pleasure to talk to you, Larry, and to your listeners, and I agree with very much of what Professor Klein has already said, but I think that another provision of the regulations kind of create a bit of a gray area with respect to just scholarships in particular, because there is a specific regulatory provision that talks about non-discrimination in terms of financial assistance that a university makes available to its students. And while it does permit specific sex-specific scholarships in certain circumstances, most sort of quintessentially when someone has left it in their will or created a trust or something to fund a scholarship at a particular university, that there can be sex-restricted scholarships in that instance as long as the overall impact of the school's scholarship program is, quote, non-discriminatory or doesn't create a discrimination on the basis of sex. And so, I mean, this hasn't been a very scrutinized area of Title IX's application to the practices of colleges and universities. And there's not a lot to go on to predict whether the Department of Education would be more persuaded by the general permissivity of affirmative action that's set out in one part of the regulations, or whether it would be looking, at least with respect to scholarships, to really zero in on this particular provision. If it's the latter, as I suspect it might be, if the Department of Education is looking to apply this particular provision, there's also some questions about how exactly this provision applies. What does it mean to say that your overall scholarship program doesn't discriminate on the basis of sex? I can say that there are very smart lawyers out there who work in higher education who have recommended as a best practice that if you have some sex-segregated scholarships, sex-specific scholarships, that you make sure that those themselves are equal, because that creates a very easy accounting. You can point to a similar number of dollars available to both men and women in a restricted fashion. But it's also possible to imagine that as long as the overall scholarship, the impact of your scholarship program is equitable, then it would be okay, even if there is some emphasis on specific sex-restricted scholarships for women.
Well, and I wonder how, if at all, outcome factors in here. Everett Bartlett of Save Title IX Equity Project, which has filed these complaints against the women-centric scholarships and outreach, he was citing the fact that now in graduate schools, the majority of STEM graduate students are women by a slight majority. So his argument is, well, we're already seeing in graduate school the effect of more women and it making it more equitable. So then why do you need to do women-centric outreach, scholarships, et cetera, if we're already seeing that? Professor Klein's point is, well, the reason you see that is because of these sorts of extra efforts to try and recruit and help women you get into graduate school in this field and to go into the workforce. So, Professor Bazoufis, does this factor into it? And is there sort of a threshold point where you say mission accomplished?
Well, I definitely agree with Professor Klein's point that we are reaping the benefit of these kinds of programs that have been implemented and have been practiced and have not been challenged for decades. At the same time, I'm not sure how that factors into the legal analysis under Title IX. I don't really see a way for that to enter into the calculation of whether they're strictly legal under the regulations as written. I think that if I could write my own outcome for this debate that we're having, it would be that the Department of Education takes the opportunity of these complaints to kind of update and clarify exactly what is permitted going forward. And if I were writing that policy, I would continue to permit sex-specific scholarships in order to promote students' access to academic disciplines and occupations where they're underrepresented. And I agree with Mr. Bartlett that there should be equal attention paid to disciplines and professions where men are underrepresented as well. So if it were up to me, I would create a policy that would allow for those both to happen as long as there was a demonstrated need for sex-restricted scholarships and that overall there was a similar effort to kind of close gaps in professions that are segregated both in favor of women and in favor of men.
See, I love that you did that. You just said if you were in charge, I love that, how you think this could be resolved. Thank you for doing that. Let's take a listener call. This is from Nicole in Santa Monica. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to say that I agree with your last speaker, that I think that there are still some real deficits in the STEM professions that justify the types of scholarships that we're seeing. And even if we have women participating in comparable numbers to men in graduate programs, there are still real impacts that you're seeing out in the professions. And so encouraging more women through these types of scholarships, I think, do promote the equitable goals of Title IX, and I think, it would be an excellent opportunity for the Department of Education to clarify them. And I do think, comparing right now male-only scholarships to female-only scholarships, which appears to be what Mr. Bartlett did, is somewhat misleading because it doesn't take into account the number of gender-blind scholarships that go to men, which build in issues of implicit bias and systemic privilege. And
well, that would be interesting to know, Nicole, wouldn't it, for gender blind. What is the gender breakdown on the awards of those scholarships?
Yep. And I don't think that we can really talk about equity until we have those numbers as well.
All right. Nicole, I appreciate it. Very good points that you raised. Let's talk with Sam in Temple City. You're on Air Talk.
Hey, Larry. So I'm just offering a perspective as an engineer who's transitioning to nursing, so a male field or a typically dominated male field to a female field. And I just don't see kind of the inequity that your first guest was talking about in terms of, you know, males and females in female fields. If a male wants to go into a kind of a female-dominated field like nursing or public admission, you know, I don't see the barrier. Let's say as if a female wanted to go into engineering, I think it's far harder for females. I think we had maybe three females in, you know, my mechanics class as an undergrad. You know, it's just far easier for males to transition.
Well, and so what are the reasons based on your observations that is? Is it because the culture of engineering is just not as open to accepting women and that nursing, for example, has a more welcoming, open culture to men to join it? Is it the educational process leading up to that? What have you seen?
You know, I think that's part of it. You know, I know that the nursing field does welcome men. I just think, you know, that you are right in the sense that, you know, I've worked in the industry as well as an engineer, and it is less welcoming to women. I mean, that's just the way it is.
All right. Sam, I appreciate and wish you the best of luck as you change professions to become a nurse. I do want to thank our guest for taking part in the conversation, talking about this challenge to women-specific scholarships and outreach programs, particularly in STEM fields that colleges and universities have undertaken in recent years. We had Diane Klein, University of Laverne Law Professor, Aaron Bazouvis, Western New England University Law Professor, and Everett Bartlett, President of SAVE Title IX Equity Project, which has filed the complaints under Title IX against these schools offering women-specific scholarships and outreach for STEM, as well as other fields. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. So good to have you with us. Coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, actor Stephen Root, who plays a handler to a hitman in the HBO series Barry, just received his first Emmy nomination after appearing in nearly 800 TV episodes and 100 films. Stephen Root, no problem staying employed as an actor. We'll hear from him on Fresh Air coming up at noon. We'll be back right after a live update from Julie Slater. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Terrific to have you with us. My thanks again to Libby Dankman for sitting in the past couple of days on the program while I was getting myself well. Joining us now, the author of Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide, which takes a look at for how long Americans have sorted themselves politically in larger cities, now, of course, along the coasts versus rural areas. The author of the book from Stanford University, where he's professor of political science and senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, Jonathan A. Rodden. Professor Rodden, good to have you with us today.
Well, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Your book, Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide, first takes us back to tell us for how long this has been going on, that really, you know, this dates back even pre-railroad, but that we've sorted ourselves along the old railroad line.
Right. We've started noticing this a lot more recently, but as we look back, this kind of correlation between population density and Democratic voting is something that has been around for a long time. And I trace it to, it really kind of emerged in the 1920s and then especially in the New Deal period. But it has this roots in the labor movement and the concentration of manufacturing and workers in cities. And then when those groups made alliances with labor unions and eventually with the Democrats, that's when this started. And we can really see the legacy of that still hanging around in today's voting behavior.
Is it odd to you, though, that as cities have turned over and largely given up their manufacturing bases, and that you've got now knowledge workers and public employees dominating, that you've got a whole different demographic that is majority in many cities today, but the politics remains the same?
Right. That's part of what's so interesting about it is we certainly can't connect necessarily today's concentration of Democrats in cities so clearly to the Industrial Revolution, especially if we look at some places like cities like Santa Barbara, where they're overwhelmingly Democratic, but there were no factories and there were no mobilized labor unions in the early part of the century. So some things have really changed. You know, once the Democrats got that urban base, they sort of started to take up urban issues. They started to kind of form alliances with other groups of urban voters over time as new political issues have come to the fore. So once abortion became an issue in the 80s, people in urban areas tend to have more liberal views on that issue and other social issues related to religion and moral values, gay marriage and other related issues. And then when the gun issue comes along, immigration, race, all these issues, people in urban areas have preferences that are somewhat to the left of people in suburbs and rural areas. And once those issues become activated, the Democrats end up kind of starting with their initial base, they start to then take up the urban position on those other issues, and the party becomes increasingly urban over time.
I think the view of many leading Democrats has been demographics are on our side, and as a more diverse America, a better educated America, comes of voting age and becomes ever more invested in voting and political life, that is going to swamp the GOP essentially. And that this will become more than just a heavily urban concentrated phenomenon. But do you think that that's not necessarily going to happen in the near term?
Well, the problem they've faced and the one that I take a lot of I really pay attention to in the book is that it's one thing to try to win majorities, and it's another thing to have those majorities be in the right places, given our system of government and the way we form our legislature through winner-take-all districts in the smaller districts in the House and statewide districts in the Senate. It matters a lot, not just whether you have a majority, and the Democrats typically win majorities if we just sort of add up all the votes in Senate elections, and they've won majorities in most of the most recent presidential elections. But having majorities in the right places in order to win legislative victories is another matter, and that's something that they've struggled with, given the geography that I've been pointing out, given their concentration in cities.
We understand how that plays out in the Senate. How has this played out in state legislatures of states that have Democratic majorities but have Republican-controlled legislatures? How does that happen?
Well, this is something that people have been paying a lot of attention to recently, and of course, the first place we look is to gerrymandering, and that is quite a big part of the story in a number of states. But if we look a little bit closer, it turns out that gerrymandering is just part of the story. And there's maybe even a precursor to that story, which is that Democrats have been so concentrated in cities that they've found it hard to win outside of cities. And so they've been able to win. Sometimes it's possible to win a majority, say, in a Senate race or a gubernatorial election in a state like Pennsylvania. But really by mobilizing a lot of votes in cities. But that doesn't really help you win the kind of pivotal district in the state legislature, which is often a kind of suburban or exurban district or maybe a mixed district. And so in a place like Pennsylvania, the Democrats have gone for decades without winning the state Senate. And that has happened both when the Democrats and when the Republicans have drawn the districts.
We're talking with Stanford University professor of political science, Jonathan A. Rodden. He's also a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, and he founded and directs the Stanford Spatial Social Science Lab as well. He's author of Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. You can ask questions of him on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org, or you can join us at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. Do you think, as you look ahead to the 2020 presidential election, that President Trump, despite the fact that he's got historically, you know, low approval ratings, could find himself reelected because of the kind of geographic politics you're talking about?
Well, that's a good question. And this is something that you know, both parties are really trying to think about. Where are they going to get the votes they need to win the pivotal states? So when we're talking about the presidency, when we're talking about the Electoral College, it really matters who wins those pivotal states kind of in the middle, the ones that are contested. And so it has come to be the case in recent years that these end up being battles over turnout between urban voters and kind of ex-urban and rural voters. And turnout has just been not just in the last election, but for a long time now, much higher. And this is kind of an interesting thing about the U.S. in contrast to other countries. Our turnout tends to be much higher in rural areas, and it's dreadfully low in urban areas. Sometimes in the urban core of a big U.S. city, it'll be below 50%, and in the suburbs, it might be north of 75%. So that's a big difference. And the parties have a lot of incentive to try to affect turnout in those places. And so I think we will see a battle over turnout between especially urban and rural areas, but a big part of the battle will be in suburbs.
What do you think Democrats can take from the success with the House in 2018? I mean, beyond having an unpopular president, are there particular approaches they took in those suburban and ex-urban districts that you think are a template for the future?
Right. In some ways, they're taken from the past. The Democratic Party has always been an incredibly diverse party, and there's always been a big difference between the kind of urban base, the urban core, and the folks who are out there trying to win suburban and rural districts. And that hasn't changed. And I think what we've seen in the past was that the Democrats were able to nominate and run a very different type of candidate in suburban and rural districts than they did in urban districts. And they were able to get away with that. That's become harder over time, and especially with all the media attention to the squad and all of the debates about that. But it does seem to be the case that the Democrats still have the ability to nominate candidates in places like Kentucky or in rural Oklahoma, I mean, suburban Oklahoma City or suburban Salt Lake City, that are able to eke out majorities.
Well, and we saw that, of course, Orange County here in Southern California. And I guess, it is funny because you mentioned the members of the squad who, get all the attention from media and from President Trump. But I think there are more representatives like those from Southern California who are first termers who have to represent split districts and have to be more moderate than there are new members of the squad type politics.
That's right. And that's kind of an old problem for parties of the left and democracies that use winner-take-all districts. It's something labor parties have always kind of struggled with, that you have this urban core that tends to be very progressive, and they're really just reflecting the views of their constituents. But those views are really pretty far away from, say, the views of the median voter in Orange County. And so a Democratic representative of a place like that has to cringe when all the media attention is given to the urban representatives. Or, in Britain, if you're a moderate Labour Party member and, all the attention obviously is given to Jeremy Corbyn, this is also a problem for you if you're running in a kind of a suburban pivotal district. So that's kind of the problem they face. And the media attention given to the kind of the loudest voices and the most interesting voices can be a problem for them.
We're talking about the underrepresentation politically of cities based on their population size and the challenge for Democrats, though they get larger raw numbers of votes typically, where
those votes come from, and the tight concentration of that voting leaves Democrats with a real challenge. We'll continue our conversation with Stanford University professor of political science, Jonathan A. Rodden, in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the deep roots of the urban-rural political divide in America. Jonathan A. Rodden is author of Why Cities Lose. He's at Stanford, where he's political science professor and also a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. If you have questions for him about the premise of his book, as well as some of the recommendations he makes to Democrats attempting to increase their political power, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Specifically, to increase Democratic political power, how much of a difference would it make to move to, you know, what some European countries use, proportional representation instead of the winner-take-all American model?
Right. This is something that lots of European countries did early in the century when those urban labor-oriented parties first started to enter the scene. They really started to squeeze out some of the existing parties, and because they were fearful of that, they got together and voted kind of strange coalitions of parties got together and voted for reform that created a more proportional electoral system. And there are some countries, the U.S. And Britain and Canada, Australia and New Zealand initially, that avoided that reform and stayed with single-member districts. So the question is, what would happen in a country like the United States if it made that reform, that kind of reform today? And I think there are a couple of things that might emerge. I mean, one of the things that happens when a democracy moves to proportional representation as we end up with more political parties and more competition, entry of parties like Greens and perhaps libertarians or liberal parties. And it really changes the way that different issues are bundled together by the parties and can have the impact of reducing the kind of polarization, this kind of bimodal mindset that we've gotten into. So one of the nice things about proportional representation is that it can just reduce polarization. And it also creates a situation in which parties are represented according to their vote share, and geography becomes quite a bit less important in a system like that.
When you look at European countries that have that sort of proportional representation, is there even more antipathy, though, from ex-urban and rural residents because they feel like they get run roughshod over by where all the people live?
Well, I haven't noticed that emerging as a real issue. It just the whole kind of urban-rural frame to politics seems less present in proportional representation countries. And it turns out that it's not the case necessarily that urban parties are necessarily left parties. So it turns out lots of urban people, especially in the kind of wealthy knowledge economy city centers, tend to be right of center on economic issues, but left of center on social issues. And so in a place like Sweden, there are parties that push together those issues. We have liberal parties and others who are pro gay marriage and pro abortion rights, but anti-tax, for instance. And those parties actually, when they are able to form governments, they form coalitions with parties of the right that are stronger in rural areas. So it doesn't really turn into this battle between cities and rural areas. It's our system really pushes us into that battle. And we see it in Britain, and we now see it in a very strong way in Canada also.
Joaquin has a terrific point to raise on the AirTalk page. Says, in this similar to at-large council members, weren't cities sued and forced to have distinct geographic districts on civil rights grounds? And of course they were, is absolutely right. Because what happened is that the dominant population was able to elect all of those at-large council district seats. And so you would have racial and ethnic minority groups would end up shut out of the process. They tended to concentrate in specific districts, but wouldn't have anyone who lived in that district end up actually being elected to an at-large seat. I suppose you could argue that for ex-urban and rural Americans, they would be in the place there of the minority group in the United States, and they would be concerned about losing their seat at the table in, you know, one of these other political reform measures, Professor?
Yeah, I think if we had a proportional electoral system, that one of the nice things about it is I don't think anyone really has to worry about losing a seat at the table. They would if their party was one of the smaller parties, they would have the opportunity to form a coalition with another party. I think in the context of school board elections or municipal elections in California under the California Voting Rights Act, where partisanship is much less an issue, and in some of these races, some of these elections, race and ethnicity really become important considerations. I think that's really a pretty different scenario, but it is an interesting comparison, and I think there's a lot that we still want to learn about the big transition that's been taking place in California from at-large to winner-take-all districts. And one of the things that happens once a community gets that demand letter and they start to introduce electoral districts, elections become very non-competitive. We end up drawing a bunch of districts around the existing incumbents, and the elections end up not even being held because no one challenges the incumbents. So there is something nice about having competitive elections, and at-large elections do introduce more turnout and better competition. And there are ways of structuring those that are not harmful to minorities. For instance, if we use ranked choice voting.
Now, in many American cities, there are efforts to make them denser and to make public transit people's preferred mode of getting around, the big issue in California with the housing crisis that exists. But despite that, is it true that we are becoming more suburbanized? And then what are the implications for politics through that?
Right. This is one of the things that if we're living in one of these coastal cities, it seems to us that there's this big renaissance of cities. And we see lots of people moving back into cities like San Francisco, and we see increasing rents. But in fact, in much of the country, the opposite thing is happening, and people are suburbanizing at a pretty impressive rate. But what that means is that Democrats and Republicans are actually becoming, in places like suburban Houston, more intermixed, and we're becoming a little less segregated by partisanship in those places where the exurbs are really growing quickly.
And so the parties are going to have to do, as we saw in the Orange County congressional race, try and court across party lines. Thank you so much, Professor Rodden. Good to talk with you about your new book.
Thanks for having me.
Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide, Stanford University Professor of Political Science, Jonathan A. Rodden, the author, is also senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air comes up next here on 89.3. Back with you tomorrow morning at 10.